you do remember these girls, would it be unusual for you as a 32-year-old guy to have dated a woman as young as 17? That would be a, what, 15-year difference, or a girl 18. Do you remember dating girls that young at that time?
Not generally, no. If I did, you know, I'm not going to dispute anything, but I don't remember anything like that.
But you don't specifically remember having any girlfriend that was in her late teens even at that time?
I don't remember that, and I don't remember ever dating any girl without the permission of her mother. And I think in her statement, she said that her mother actually encouraged her to go out with me.
Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore on Sean Hannity's radio show on Friday. Five women have accused Moore of pursuing them when they were teenagers and he was in his early 30s. The latest today, a woman named Beverly Young Nelson came forward saying he fondled her against her will when she was 16 years old. It took place in his car.
I was determined that I was not going to allow him to force me to have sex with him. I was terrified. He was also trying to pull my shirt off. I thought that he was going to rape me.
Another woman, Lee Korfman, accused Moore of having sexual contact with her when she was 14. That's a charge he has flatly denied. Some Republicans, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, have called for Moore to step aside and end his campaign for Senate. Others are standing by him. Evangelicals make up almost half of all Alabama voters and will be particularly important to his candidacy. And there are evangelicals who believe in what's been called early courtship. Girls in their teens marrying older men. Catherine Brightbill is with the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. She was exposed to this idea of early courtship while growing up as an evangelical teen in Florida. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Julie Ingersoll. She's a professor of religious studies at the University of North Florida. Welcome to you, Julie.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you. Catherine, let's begin with you. You were a teenager in the 1990s in Bradenton, Florida, and you were homeschooled. When did you begin hearing about these so-called early courtships?
It was probably when I was in middle school that the idea of courtship started really taking off within the homeschool world. And it was around that time that I started hearing about courtships with teenagers and adult men as being acceptable.
Acceptable by whom?
Acceptable in those in the communities that practiced or taught about courtship.
Mm. Okay, so, and these are particular strains of evangelical Christianity?
It's across a lot of different denominations. There's it pops up in a number of different denominations. Yes, particular strains originated within the homeschool world, and then was popularized. The courtship movement was popularized within broader evangelicalism in the late 90s by Josh Harris's book, I Kissed Dating Goodbye.
Hmm. And Julie Ingersoll, can you elaborate on that? How widespread is this idea in evangelical Christianity?
Well, it's hard to get an actual number on how many evangelicals there are, right? So this is an obscure thread in the evangelical movement, which is a really diverse movement. But I've argued in much of my work that their influence far outstrips their numbers because they have a real core focus on homeschooling, and they've been some of the most important evangelicals in regards to promoting homeschooling curriculum and conventions and various other things. So that's not to say all homeschoolers are involved in this either, but the core group of homeschool leaders that are part of this very outspoken fundamentalist, sometimes called dominionist, other words for them are the quiverful movement or biblical patriarchy. It's a very small number of evangelicals, but it's a really influential subset of evangelicals.
And what is the basic philosophy behind it? What's the idea behind this idea of early courtship?
Well, the idea is that to be marriageable, men need to be self-sufficient, but to be marriageable for girls or for women is to be able to reproduce. And so the ideal of a man being autonomous and independent and self-sufficient is the exact opposite of the ideals for girls, which is to be dependent and submissive. And to be malleable enough to become a helpmeet in the exercise of dominion of her future husband. And so in that sense, to establish a marriage when you're in your teens and you don't yet have your own identity serves the ideology, the gender ideology, really well.
Mm. And so this idea that Roy Moore has said that, oh, their mother said it was okay, then that would make sense in this context?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, there's to some extent, this is a little anachronistic, right? Because that movement didn't exist when Moore did this, or when he allegedly did this. Mm-hmm. But the movement, I have argued, is shaping the context in which the claims of what he did are interpreted. So they're really relevant for how evangelicals in Alabama are thinking about how to understand the controversy. So contemporary versions of this would probably be somewhat critical of his approaching their mothers and not their fathers, for example, because courtship happens under the watchful eye of a patriarch in a family, a father, and not particularly a mother. But certainly parental, it is an arrangement that's between the man who's pursuing the girl and the parents of the girl.
And Catherine, if you could elaborate more on your experiences and what you saw around you in terms of your friends or other people that were homeschooled. Did you actually see this in practice?
Yes, I did see it in practice with several of my friends who began courtships at 14. One of them married the day before she turned 18. Another one married the man she was courting when she turned 21, which was actually somewhat unusual that she waited that long, but her parents wanted her to go to college.
And, yeah. And in general, so in your community or in this community, it was generally accepted that a 14-year-old would be dating an adult?
Yes. Not every girl that age would begin a courtship, but that was the age that was considered acceptable for a man to approach her father and ask for permission.
And you said that you saw a leader in the religious right actually flirting with some of your friends. And what happened to him?
Yeah. He is still operating as a leader in the religious right. And as far as I know, I don't know whether he still flirts with teenage girls, but he he's still leading, and he's leading fights right now about, he's led fights against bathroom bills and would pop up protesting at LGBT pride events.
And Julie, this is not unique to Christianity, is it? I mean, you look at other conservative outposts of religion, conservative Islam, ultra-Orthodox Jews, you do see often an age disparity in certain courtships, if you will.
Yeah, in patriarchal religions, I do think that you find that. And one of the ways in which I think this is really insidious is that everybody's not going to embrace ideas about grown men dating teenagers. But when you see television shows like the Duggars TLC series, they didn't have their daughters dating full-grown men, but they had all of the rhetoric and the arguments about courtship and about female purity that culminate, really, that naturally lead to these other kinds of arrangements that they wouldn't have depicted on television, but that would have been happening in the circles around them, just the way Catherine describes.
And what about other opinions in the evangelical community? As you said earlier, they're not all in favor of this.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah. I mean, evangelicalism actually boasts a really vibrant feminist movement that's been around since the 70s. And that's just another strand of it, right?
Well, is this a reaction to that, in a way?
No. Actually, the evangelical feminist movement probably predates this.
Well, that's what I meant. Is this a reaction to the feminism?
Maybe. I mean, I think it's a reaction to so one of the architects of some of this, his name was Doug Phillips, and he no longer has his business or his church position or his ministry because of inappropriate contact with a young girl who was his nanny. And he would have laid out all of this as a criticism in response to feminism in general, but not specifically to feminism within evangelicalism, but very critical of feminism in our culture.
Okay, so given all of what we've just been discussing, I guess it's not surprising to you that Roy Moore still enjoys broad evangelical support in Alabama after these allegations have come out.
Unfortunately, it's not.
Julie Ingersoll, religious studies professor at the University of North Florida, author of Building God's Kingdom Inside the World of Christian Reconstruction. And Catherine Brightbill is legislative policy analyst at the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why Hollywood sex abuse stories leave out black women. That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Before the break, we talked about the sexual assault accusations against Roy Moore. New allegations against different men seem to tumble out every day. Could this be a long overdue moment of reckoning for powerful abusers? Maybe, but there is a hole in this conversation. So far, not all, but most of the alleged victims we've heard from have been white women. Some say that's because for women of color, the stakes of going public are still too high. To discuss this, I'm joined now by Karen Atiyah, Global Opinions Editor for The Washington Post. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Clarkesha Kent, a writer for The Root, BET, and other outlets. Hi, Clarkesha.
Hey, thank you also for having me.
Of course. Well, Karen, let's begin with you. Back in July, you wrote a piece about accusations against R. Kelly, and your piece included this line: Kelly's alleged acts are dependent on the invisibility of black women and girls in the United States. What did you mean by that line?
It's just really hard to fathom how a figure like R. Kelly, growing up in the 90s and the early aughts, his songs were so huge. They were very much a fabric of, parties and growing up. But at the same time, we knew about Aaliyah. We knew about the allegations surrounding his relationship with her. We knew from even people who grew up in Chicago, we knew about the rumors about his predatory behavior on young black girls and women. And so, I think what the Harvey Weinstein saga has shown is that this whole kind of wave of Me Too, a lot of it depends on how much we think of the victims and where we place them in society. If black women and girls were worthy of the same sort of care, protection, and respect, it's hard for me not to think that R. Kelly would have been done a long time ago. Even Jane Fonda has said, we're talking about Harvey Weinstein's victims because they are famous and white as well. Mm-hmm. One thing about R. Kelly is that a number of his victims were sort of, they weren't famous, they weren't necessarily rich, they don't have the same sort of platforms that some of these high-profile accusers are having in this moment now. And so that also speaks to the sort of continued invisibility of his victims.
Right. And Clarkesha, what do you make of this moment? We're calling it the Harvey Weinstein moment. Do you think that this will mean a day of reckoning for the R. Kellys of the world and for others who have sort of escaped the glare?
Some of these predators, like you have R. Kelly, Bill Cosby, Woody Allen, some of these people who've had these allegations out there for years, still aren't getting dragged into light like they should, as compared to Weinstein, as compared to Louis C.K., all these other people. I agree with it. Like, it's because of who they're preying on, how they're preying on them. Without those platforms, without the protection of some of these privileges that some of these accusers have, I don't know if we'll ever see some of these people like R. Kelly and Bill Cosby get the justice that they should. Now, am I kind of shocked that, some of these men are actually, the consequences are being applied to them? Yeah, kind of. I'm not going to discount how much of a watershed moment it is. It is big. Like, it is interesting to note who's getting punished, whose words are being listened to, whose stories are being accounted for, and who's actually getting to step forward. again, the stakes are still very high for if women of color happen to do the same.
For me and for a lot of other black women, we're just hoping that those men who've gotten away with preying upon black women and girls can also face their just desserts as well.
And do you feel like that you're not getting the support from white feminists when it comes to that in particular, to R. Kelly or to any other stories of black women or girls being victimized?
It's fascinating. I mean, the first thing I sort of thought of when all of this was happening was Chris Brown, R. Kelly, the fact that they can release a new song together called Juicy Booty, of all things, it's just astounding to me that this is not a part of this conversation. And it's sweeping all of these industries. It's sweeping politics. It's sweeping Hollywood. It's sweeping the fashion industry. So it just would make sense that we increase our scrutiny on these men and on the music industry in general. And I find myself in conversations wondering, is it because mainstream society views black men as predators or sexually deviant and that's expected of black men? Or is it because, again, black women are undervalued or devalued in this society? Perhaps it's a perverse combination of both. Perhaps, again, we're not talking about it because even within the black community, let's be honest, you have defenders of both men who will say, who cares, their music and their art is great, or who cares, these women were poor and or were just looking for a way to get famous. So, you know, they might be making up their allegations or they are pursuing these men in order to move up in society. I mean, it's astounding to me. It really is.
Mm. Karkisha, what about you? What do you think of that? I mean, do you come down on one side or the other? You two think it's a bit of both, the fact that society may look at black men in a certain light as predators and may also be dismissive of black women and their stories.
I think a combination of both is the most accurate. And then the violence that's committed against us isn't really taken seriously because some of these more historical stereotypes that stem from slavery. We're kind of undervalued at every turn.
You wrote about Lupita Nyong'o and her accusations against Harvey Weinstein. Weinstein specifically responded to her allegations. He hasn't really responded specifically to other allegations except to say that they're not true. So what do you make of that?
A lot of women of color, a lot of black women haven't stepped forward for reasons like this. Like it's enough to have your reputation and your integrity kind of called into question for daring to accuse a man of something like this in public. But then you bring the racial factor into this, right? Because of that, I feel like he was comfortable challenging her in that way, to publicly kind of like gaslight her and almost belittle her. I don't even know if he realizes it, but I think it's a very honest display of kind of white male privilege.
Karen, finally, what do you think has to happen for more black women to come forward and tell their stories about what's been happening to them?
I mean, I think part of this, you know, reflects also on the journalism industry and the media, right? Part of our job as journalists and as editors is to go and check out some of these open rumors and to try to talk to the victims and try to get the truth. And so I think we need to extend that same sort of rigor and curiosity about women, teen girls who are in the South Side of Chicago who may have come into contact with R. Kelly, as we do to women who are in Hollywood or in New York or in Washington. Because ultimately, even though the race of the victims, their social status are different, these are all still stories about abusing power and exploitation.
Karen Atiyah is Global Opinions Editor for The Washington Post, and Clarkeisha Kent is a writer for The Root, BET, and other outlets. Thank you both so much.
Of course.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, our regular Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here to talk about some new First Amendment cases the Supreme Court is taking up. And if you look at Pete Souza's Instagram account, it looks like he's trolling President Trump.
I think I've been subtle, respectful, playful, especially when you compare it to the comments that some people make on Twitter.
Former official White House photographer Pete Souza, he's out with a new photo book documenting 8 years of the Obama presidency. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Brett Talley is 36 years old. He's a Harvard Law graduate. He's a lawyer, but he's never actually tried a case. Talley works as a deputy assistant attorney general at the Justice Department, and he's blogged about being a fan of the National Rifle Association. So why am I telling you about this guy named Brett Talley? Well, the Trump administration has nominated him to be a federal trial judge in Alabama. He is the fourth Trump pick the American Bar Association has rated not qualified to sit on the bench. It's Monday, so that means Jessica Levinson is here, our regular legal eagle and a law professor at Loyola Law School. Hi.
Let's bring you the depressing legal news of the day.
I know. So four unqualified?
Four unqualified. So I will say two things that sound kind of contradictory. The first is it is really unprecedented to have this many candidates who are nominees that are rated as unqualified. The ABA is the American Bar Association. It's been around forever and then some, and they have a long history of rating judicial candidates based on confidential interviews, based on qualifications, based on experience. So on the one hand, you look at this and you say, four unqualified, and since 1989, I think there otherwise have been two unqualified ratings. So it seems like there's an explosion. But we have to remember that Donald Trump is not coordinating with the ABA. So typically speaking, these nominees would never see the light of day because the president, other than George W. Bush, I think since Eisenhower, other than George W. Bush, all the presidents have worked in concert with the ABA. So you would never have someone, you would never put
you would
forward
never have
someone
them in the first
who
place.
You would know would get
and,
a not qualified rating.
And what constitutes as unqualified?
Well, it can be a variety of things like, for instance, in the case of Brett Talley, he has never tried a case and I think he never argued a motion in federal court. And there were also issues related to the idea that he doesn't have the judicial temperament. So some of the ABA rating is based on, again, confidential interviews with people who have worked with these people. So not qualified could be length of time. It could be temperament. It could be lack of experience, which is what we're seeing with a lot of the nominees here. And for instance, we have people who, this is kind of unprecedented. We have people blogging, calling Hillary Clinton, Hillary Rotten Clinton, saying that they're pledging their undying allegiance to the NRA. This is not our usual judicial nominee.
And yet he made it through a committee. And he's awaiting full confirmation in the Senate.
Exactly. And yet he made it through a committee on a party line vote. And let's think about how sad that is, actually. We're talking about members of the judiciary who have lifetime appointments for this reason. They're supposed to be above politics. They're supposed to be separate from the partisan fray. And now we have nominees who are, one, being raided, who are so young and kind of even outside the mainstream of conservative and are being rated not qualified and will probably be on the bench for about 40 years. And that's the name of the game for President Trump. He is reshaping the judicial branch in a way that will reverberate for the lifetime of everybody who's listening to the show.
Wow. Well, could it happen in four or three or three and a half slash 8 years from now that a, let's say, a very liberal Democrat becomes the next president and does the same thing? Then what happens?
Yes, but I would say yes, but no, for these two reasons. One is that President Trump has a lot of vacancies and he's trying to fill them very quickly. And he has a lot of people who are eligible to take senior status, which is another way of saying you can step down and free open your spot for someone to be nominated. So just the percentage of people that President Trump can fill in the judiciary means that it will be difficult for the, you know, the next president, if that's a liberal Democrat, to be able to fill the same number. But I would also say Democrats just really aren't as good at this as Republicans. Republicans vote in lockstep. Senator Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, engineered just an unprecedented slowdown of President Trump's nominees, excuse me, President Obama's nominees, to the extent that Merrick Garland, the Supreme Court nominee, never even got a hearing. Mm-hmm. So Republicans are great at this. Democrats, again, it's that old joke, I'm not a member of an organized party, I'm a Democrat.
Okay. All right. So let's move on to some other news today. The Supreme Court has agreed to take up a couple of cases, three cases actually, that deal with the limits on free speech under the First Amendment, one of which involves a California law.
Yeah, this is there. this is a momentous term in just the sheer number of First Amendment cases we're getting. And so it's interesting because President Trump keeps talking about, he uses the First Amendment like a shield and a sword. And he says it means this, it doesn't mean this. The Supreme Court's going to tell us in a lot of different areas what it means. And the California law is based on, the California law is the abortion case, mm-hmm. where we're talking about pregnancy crisis centers and whether or not the California legislature said you need to post information that tells people that they can either get low cost or no cost prenatal care, contraceptions, and abortion. And some of these pregnancy crisis centers are saying, you're forcing me to say things that I don't want to say. So the First Amendment is both about allowing you to be able to say things and allowing you to not have to say things if you don't want to. Now, the California legislature, on the other hand, is saying, look, we surveyed 200 of these crisis centers, and we saw that they had misleading information. And we have to, there's a compelling state interest in providing women with this information. And so this is an important matchup. The sheer number of First Amendment cases, I think, means that there are at least four likely conservative votes on the Supreme Court, and they want to say now, because they have a majority, this is what the First Amendment means.
That's interesting, because there are also laws in California that say you have to post whether or not something's a carcinogen in coffee shops or at gas stations. So would that be considered a sort of a similar argument, that we are providing you with information you might need to make a decision that affects your health?
I think that's a great analogy, except that there's kind of a lesser complaint on behalf of the people who own the restaurant or the hotel, that it's against my personal belief to say a fact, which is there might be carcinogens in this building. So people feel different about their health and safety risks in this building, even though that can affect their pocketbook, as they do saying you might be able to obtain an abortion. And you know, for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, there's religious reasons as well. So there's another case about sloganeering in Minnesota, whether or not you can wear campaign buttons at a polling place.
So this is a case that deals with someone who wore a T-shirt that I think said, "Don't tread on me," and there was a logo of the Tea Party. And he also had a button that I think was related to the Tea Party. And he was at his polling place. And so we have a tradition of saying there's like a little buffer zone of no free speech zone around polling places, because we don't want people kind of electioneering, like as you're walking from your car to, you know, check the ballot and say, like, you've got to vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump is our savior. And the question is this broader? Because this isn't just don't vote for Hillary Clinton or vote for Donald Trump. So this is about, it's a bit broader. It's about party affiliation. It's about ideology. And what the challengers are saying, first of all, they don't like those free speech zones to begin with. But they're also saying, you can't be this broad. We know that there are special concerns when it comes to the ballot box. But I have special concerns in saying, don't tread on me. I support the Tea Party. And we've seen, again, a Supreme Court where I think they've been very generous to those who are First Amendment challengers, saying my rights need to be vindicated.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and avid T-shirt wearer. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Pete Souza is here as the official chief White House photographer. He took millions of photos of Barack Obama over 8 years. We'll talk about some of the highlights next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Pete Souza has taken nearly 2 million photos of former President Barack Obama. He was the official White House photographer for 8 years. There are famous photos, like the one where Obama and his aides are gathered in the Situation Room the night bin Laden was killed. And there are private, tender moments with Michelle, Sasha, and Malia. Now Pete Souza is out with a photo book. It's called Obama, An Intimate Portrait. It includes more than 300 images. And we have a photo blog up at our website if you want to check out some of the images that we're about to discuss. Go to kcrw.com/curious. And Pete Souza joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, how did you winnow down that number from 2 million to 300? What was your process for deciding what should go in the book?
It was an agonizing process. I mean, I tried to create a narrative in this book to show what his presidency was like in those 8 years, but also give a glimpse of what he is like as a person, and then also include aesthetic pictures that give you a broad sweep of what it's like to be in the presidency. I think I did a good edit, but people are going to have to judge for themselves.
Now, you met him when he was sworn in as a senator, Illinois senator, back in 2005, and you were working for the Chicago Tribune. You were a photojournalist for the Chicago Tribune. So how did you make the transition from being a journalist to being White House photographer?
Well, I didn't approach things necessarily in a different way. I mean, I had a different employer, obviously, and I was on the government payroll. But, you know, the style of my photography and the way I approached any given situation didn't really change in the pictures I was taking.
The first two images of the book are images of Obama sitting behind a desk. The first desk is, he's on Capitol Hill. It's January 5th, 2005, when he's a senator, and it's in a really nondescript room. There are fluorescent lights overhead, no windows, a computer that's just been, you know, delivered. It appears it's on the floor. He's sitting behind a pretty bare desk with his feet up looking at papers. And then the second image is him on the phone looking at papers, sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office. And it's a very different tableau. And yet he seems like he's doing the exact same thing. He could be reading the same papers. So what did you want to convey with these two images starting off the book?
Those are in my introduction. And I was trying to make the point of when I was photographing him as a senator, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, okay, someday this guy is going to be a national leader. He may even run for president. He may even be president. So I was consciously making pictures that might contrast with if he ever did become president.
And he says, he writes the foreword in your book, and he says that he spent more time with you than anyone else besides his family. And I guess you became very good friends with him.
I did become friends with him. When you spend that much time with any one person, you naturally become close. Sometimes we played cards together on Air Force One during long trips, things like that. And occasionally there'd be banter back and forth, maybe about, you know, last night's basketball game or something like that.
Well, did you ever see him unguarded, in the sense that I think the way that we have watched him, or we watched him for 8 years, is he seemed so deliberate, his words so carefully chosen, and even in unscripted moments, he seemed, well, I don't want to say buttoned up, but planned. Like he wouldn't say something entirely unexpected ever. Did you ever see a moment where he did act unexpectedly?
Well, I saw him unguarded all the time, but I think actually a lot of those unguarded moments are in my book. He had an acute sense of the words that he would say that could be made public, people paid attention to, that when the President of the United States speaks, it's important. It has repercussions in the country, in Congress, around the world, and I think he was always consciously aware of that.
And was he consciously aware that the photos you were taking were for history, for posterity? Was he self-conscious in that way? Or did he forget that you were there taking photos sometimes?
It's really interesting. I have this picture taken on January 5th, 2005. So the first day, his first day in the Senate. And he's eating a sandwich in his office. Sasha and Malia were with him. And I'm probably 6 feet away. And it's this totally unguarded moment. And no one's paying attention to me. And even then, he was the kind of subject that the presence of the camera and the presence of me didn't bother him at all. He just kind of went about his business. I also have this intuitive sense how to blend into the background and not disturb, you know, what's going on. And I think he appreciated that. And I think that made it easier for him to have me around.
Did he ever say to you, don't take pictures of this?
I can't recall a time that he did.
Wow. So that's why you have 2 million photos. What is his favorite photo that you took?
Anything that has Sasha and Malia in it. You know, it was always funny. There's a picture in the book of, it's a staffer's son dressed up like Spider-Man on Halloween, and he had come to visit the president. And as he was leaving, the president says, "Zap me one more time." And you see the president getting zapped by Spider-Man. And we used to hang these pictures on the walls of the West Wing, and we hung that one up. And he saw it when he walked down to the Situation Room and said, "Oh, that's like my favorite photo." And it was probably like, you know, 2 days later that he saw one with Sasha and Malia, and he's like, "Well, that's my favorite photo." So anytime he saw like a really nice photo of that included Sasha and Malia, that was always one of his favorites, and it kind of continually changed.
There's one of him hugging Malia in the living room with there's a Christmas tree in the background, and this was December 14th, 2012, the day of the shooting at Sandy Hook. What was going on in that moment?
Let me just set the scene a little bit. He had just, you know, 4 weeks before been elected to his second term in his presidency. And then this is the time of year when the White House takes on this aura of Christmas. It's just glorious. Decorations everywhere. This picture was taken in the private residence. You see their Christmas tree that they've already decorated. And he has come upstairs just a few hours after the shootings in Newtown to get his wife. They were going to go down and say a few remarks at this Christmas party downstairs. And it was the first time he had seen either Sasha or Malia since the shootings. And he was hugging her. And he really just didn't let her go. I think in times like this, he was not only reacting as president, but he was reacting as a parent and imagining what it must be like to be one of those Newtown parents where you've sent your first grader off to school, you know, which we all consider a safety zone, and then they never come home again because some crazy guy shot them to death.
Can you talk a little bit about the physical and mental toll of this job on you? You began this job when you were 54. What was it like for you? Because you must have been working all the time.
It was a great privilege to do this job. I'm honored that he chose me to do it. That's sort of the first thing I'd have to say. For me, additionally, it was just the 24/7 aspect of this job, where even if you weren't at the White House, you were always monitoring everything that was going on because you didn't know when you might have to come back in. So, you know, over time, that takes its toll on you, especially when we're talking about 8 years. So it's sort of the grind of the job, just the everyday grind that wears you down more than anything.
Well, that was certainly the case when you took that iconic photo in the Situation Room the night bin Laden was killed. Can you talk about that, what it was like to be in that room?
Yeah, I mean, first I'll say that I'd been given notice that something was going to be taking place. So I was aware that I would have to be around on that Sunday. And we were at the White House all day. I mean, he had a series of meetings leading up to the raid itself, which happened like around 4 o'clock our time. So we kind of all piled into this small conference room within the Situation Room where the communications link had been set up to the guys on the ground in Pakistan. And they're all gathered around this little table. You know, you have the president, the vice president, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Secretary of State, defense, representative from the CIA, John Brennan was there, Dennis McDonough was there, the chief of staff, Bill Daley, was there. So you've got the most powerful people in our government are all in that room at the same time. And unlike any other meeting, they could not affect the outcome because they had already made their decision to launch this raid in the days and weeks before. And now they're all gathered to see how it's going to play out with those guys on the ground. And it could have gone terribly wrong, and they were helpless to do anything about it. And I think that's what leads to this tension and anxiety on their faces. You know, most of the time when I was in the Situation Room, there was conversation going on the entire time, back and forth discussion. And in this 40 minutes that we were in that little room, there was very little conversation. There was just observation.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Pete Souza, former chief official White House photographer, about his new book of photographs, 300 photographs of his time at the White House. It's called Obama, An Intimate Portrait. Well, now you have a very healthy life on Instagram where you republish these photos, some of them, and you've been called out, I guess, I don't know, or praised in some quarters for trolling Donald Trump with these photos, so that when Trump does something that's controversial, you will print a photo of Obama doing the same thing, but it's a great photo. And I'm wondering about that. Did you set out intentionally to troll President Trump?
I had no grand strategy. It was more accidental than anything. I'm sure some people look at my Instagram feed and appreciate it, and some probably look at it and don't appreciate it. But I will say this. I think I've been subtle, respectful, playful, especially when you compare it to the comments that some people make on Twitter.
Some people meaning the president? Are you not going to answer that? I'll just leave it at that. Okay. I want to talk about the last day of the presidency where President Obama, you have a picture of him shaking hands with Donald Trump right after the inauguration ceremony. So what do you think of this photo? What did you capture in this photo?
This is symbolic of the transfer of power in our country. I was thinking that, you know, my time was coming to an end. President Obama's time was coming to an end, and a new administration was coming in. And I look at that photograph now, and that's what it symbolizes.
Though the look on Obama's face looks pretty grim.
I don't know if he's grim. I mean, I think that
he's not smiling.
Obviously, he wished he had been shaking hands with Hillary Clinton. That's what we all thought was going to happen, you know, including possibly the person he's shaking hands with. But it didn't turn out that way. And I think he was trying to not say or do or act in any way that would be disrespectful to the incoming president.
Finally, I want to talk about one that I think you have said is one of your favorite photos that you took, and it's a picture of a little boy named Clark Reynolds. You don't even see the president. You just see his hand and his arm, and his hand is touching the boy's cheek as the boy is looking up at him. And the boy is what, 3 years old?
Yeah, he was 3.
Can you talk about that photo?
Yeah, this was at a reception in the East Room for African American History Month. And gosh, I probably had covered, I don't know, dozens of these similar type events in the 8 years. And it very seldom leads to a good photograph, in that the president makes remarks from this little stage, welcomes his guests, and then usually there's like a rope line set up and he'll quickly shake hands with people on the rope line and then leave. And I saw this little kid standing at the front of the rope line. His necktie is hanging over the rope. And so I kind of had my eye on him when the president started shaking hands with people. And I was bent down right in front of him because I suspected the president would lean down and shake his hand too. And when the president came over for one brief second, he touched his face. Then the president bent down and looked Clark in the eyes and said hi to him, tried to straighten his tie a little bit. And I have that whole sequence. But that first picture before he bent down caught my attention, and I just felt that was the moment, not when he was eye to eye with the young boy. I tracked down, because I didn't know the name of the kid at the time, I tracked down the mom, made sure she was all right. We were going to make the photo public, And then I made a big print of it and had the president sign it to Clark. And he wrote something like, you know, dream big dreams, you will do great things in the world.
I don't know what it is about his hand right on Clark's cheek and the expression on his on the little boy's face as he's looking up at him. I mean, it reminded me a little bit of that iconic photo of JFK shaking hands with a young Bill Clinton. That you never know.
You never know.
You know, what's going to happen? That little boy might grow up to be a president.
That would be something, wouldn't it?
That would be something. Well, Pete Souza, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me on. I look forward to seeing you in a few weeks.
Me too. That's Pete Souza. He's former chief official White House photographer. His new book is called Obama, An Intimate Portrait. I'll be speaking with Pete Souza on November 29th at the Getty Center at 7:30 p.m. If you want to check out some of the images we just talked about, you can go to kcrw.com/curious. And Christian Bordahl is here now with some
Hey there,
feedback.
Madeline. Hi. Yes, we're talking again about what seems to be this big inflection point right now about, you know, sexual harassment, sexual power dynamics, powerful men behaving badly. Saturday Night Live even felt the need to run a quiz this weekend on appropriate workplace behavior.
First question is just about office romance, which is not a big deal. We know it happens, right? But so what is the appropriate way to handle a workplace relationship? A, inform someone at HR. B, lock her in a room and make her look at it. Or C, bully her out of the entire industry.
I'm going to say A.
Yes! Oh, good! You got it!
I'm sure our listeners would have got that one right, even without the prompting there. But I asked a slightly different question of our listeners. I asked the old question about whether you can separate the art from the artists. If an artist behaves badly, do you stop watching Louis C.K. or reading whoever or listening to music by whoever it is. And Calligator responded, great art often comes from people who push envelopes, which in some way may be indicative of their general tendencies.
Hmm.
So it doesn't really answer the question, but yes, artists can be a bit wacky, I guess, is the idea.
Maybe that because they are so outré in their art, mm-hmm. they'll be outré when it comes to
exactly.
social norms.
So I put up a little Twitter poll about this. I asked, can you separate the art from the artist? People like Louis C.K., Bertolucci, Woody Allen, Chris Brown, R. Kelly.
Polanski.
Exactly. So absolutely 0% of people said no. Said yes, you can separate the art from the artist. 36% said no, bad people. No, bad people, bad art. There's no such thing. And yes, 64% said yes, the art is not the artist. I got that all wrong. It said 64% said it depends on who you want to listen to.
Okay, just check it out on Twitter.
Yes.
Don't take Christian's word for it. Thank you very much. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.